jump straight in.
Straight in. DS106 Radio. I think we're on the radio. And Lauren, can you give us a hi, hello?
Hi, hello.
Nice.
This is Lauren Haywood.
Yeah, you're on too. Good, we're in. Wow. So this is Utopian Tendencies. The date is May 29th, 2020. Yeah. This is our third episode. Wow, we're racking them up now.
It's an actual series now.
It is an actual series. And you sent me a really interesting video that I spent the morning watching and listening to and feeling like, you know, that's kind of... I'll let you introduce it because I have a lot to say, as usual. But cool. why don't you frame what you sent to me via email that's I spent my morning enjoying thoroughly.
Okay, that's good. That's a good sign. Okay, so I sent you a link. It was randomly put up by Gucci of a program I watched on BBC Four last year sometime. And it's a film made by the artist Jeremy Dello, who's an artist from the UK. Called Everybody in the Place, and I think it's the subtitle's An Incomplete History of Britain 1984 to 1992, off the top of my head, I can't remember the last bit. Yeah, and it's about an hour long and kind of provides a history of the UK or England, Scotland, Wales kind of thing. Through the lens of acid house and rave music in the UK at that time, but kind of contextualizing it within the kind of social and political kind of climate of the time as well. So it kind of it's also framed as a level politics class given to 16 to 18 year olds. So it's this artist going into the classroom to give a lecture to like 20 teenagers. About the history of the UK, kind of trying to present them their history and potentially where their own culture and sense of belonging comes from and things like that, and kind of challenges them to think about maybe what their youth culture is now, perhaps, as well. So yeah, but I'm very interested to hear what you've got to say about it, because like I haven't watched it since like I think it was shown in August or July last year or something like that. So I watched it then, and then I watched it again this morning as well.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh my God, this is an interesting introduction to UK history at that time.
I really like that. Like for me, it was such a brilliant way. His name is Jeremy Deller, is that right?
Yeah.
It was such a brilliant way as a teacher, as a pedagogue, to create a narrative of British, basically British labor history, very much is what he's talking about, because the whole thing has a fulcrum point of 1984 with the mining, what is called, again, not being from the UK, before watching this documentary, I had no idea just how, at least according to Deller, how pivotal for Britain, the breaking of the miner strike in 1984 was to kind of crushing the morale of a nation. That's yeah. Basically his argument. And he talks about the birth of, you know, what would be acid house in Britain as not only influenced and imported from Detroit and Chicago, but in which how it took on its own context in the British frame for thinking through things like race, labor, and sound systems of all things. It was super, super interesting, because how he set it up is, and we'll play clips from the movie, that would be fun, from the documentary. But how he sets it up is he basically is sitting in a room full of, you know, seniors, we would call them in the U.S., like graduating high school seniors, ready to go on to college, I think. Is that right?
Yeah.
And they're all in London, and they're a diverse group. Like, it's not like your traditional, what you would think of as like, you know, the British prep school, right? Like, these are kids from, you know, all over the world who seem to be first generation and have a, give Britain a really interesting face. And the challenge of this artist coming in, who's a male white artist, but obviously he has a really interesting delivery style, really under, it's like really subtle, but at the same time working on such a high level that it's this strange, beautiful pedagogical marriage that I just want to model and build on. But anyway, he comes in and he shows them clips from the news about music. He starts with like, hey, like, look at this thing that happened in Chicago, right? House music all night long. Say what? House music all night long. Say what? And he talks through the, you know, the 80s, the gay culture, Detroit culture, post-industrialization, and then jumps the pond to talk about Britain, and then really gets to what his point is, the miner strike, the Thatcher politics, the moment at which the people in Britain could no longer depend on the state, and the kind of ensuing kind of chaos, so much so that he talks about one particular figure very briefly, who's kind of like a Breitbart, no, what is the Brexit, Barton, you know, that whole combo.
Oh,
that,
yeah, he's exactly of the Breitbart era, but he's from before then as well.
Exactly, about how they were sowing uncertainty and chaos, even at that point during the rave culture in the late 80s, early 90s, because it is, right, it's 84 to 93. And it's interesting because it's my era when I'm graduating high school and going into college. So I was very struck by how he built this documentary. I saw that when you tweeted about this, Lauren, you included the screenshot, and I don't know if it was intentional or not, of the 1991 TV show. I think it was in Detroit or Chicago, where there was a bunch of African Americans dancing to Kraftwerk.
Yeah.
Which is the most insane scene in the movie, I think. I love it.
I've never seen anyone dance to Kraftwerk before. It's just like, I think that was like the moment where I like fell in love with this film on first watch or whatever. I was like, oh my God, this is going to be so good.
It was amazing. And he even talked about that. I'll play that clip. I have that. I can get that queued up in a second. But I'm going to throw it over to you while I queue it up. Is he even talked about that moment as being one that he goes back and watches when he's depressed. Because the idea of another culture adopting and playing with, like Kraftwerk and, you know, America, Europe and America touching in some ways. And like sharing cultures and then adopting each other's cultures in different ways, for him was like everything. And it was such a cool thing to be excited about. I loved it.
I think it wasn't even about it being global or shared across different cultures. It was just those people in that moment taking and adapting that music for their own and kind of reclaiming it. So he says they took ownership of the music in the way that Kraftwerk would have wanted, kind of thing, that they, do you know what I mean? They just made it their own. But yeah, it's, are you going to cue up the audio? Are you going to show it on the TV? Yeah, the audio. But yeah, so I included a screenshot. I haven't seen the TV show before, so yeah, it's a Detroit show, and the film explains how in Detroit they were playing around with the local TV and radio, different forms of music and cultural kind of formats. So this was a local TV show where it's basically like two lines of people on either side, and then there's like a kind of runway, and then people like there's like a neon logo sign behind them, and then they just like they're in whatever get up they want to wear kind of thing for the TV, and then they're just doing mad dance moves kind of thing.
There's some really awesome moments in this part when he's talking about Detroit and the post-industrialization, and while Detroit is the birthplace of Motown, the artists who kind of invented house felt more attached to actually the assembly line in technology than to Motown, which is kind of a big statement given, you know, the shadow that Motown casts on the musical world. It seems like almost illogical. You know what I mean? To say that. But it was a beautiful, like, break, because the documentary is also very much about this generational gap, this break. And when you create that gap, the ability for uncertainty and for the state and for malfactors to kind of come in and make it worse. And so it was like, it works on a deeply personal and state slash systemic level. It's a super smart documentary. And here's a clip where he's talking about the moment at which Kraftwerk starts touring the US in the early 80s and this kind of change point. And I think, Lauren, your point is right. It's not so much about Europe and U.S. come together, like, and sing happily. But it is about this kind of, you know, interesting exchange, you know, even if it's within a culture, because they talk about the system audio within England, which we should discuss, where even within a culture, and it's the same thing in Detroit and Chicago, right? This is not like white America, right? These are like ostracized, you know, on the margins, gay populations, African American populations doing things because they're not accepted in other spaces. So there is all of that running through it, and that's a good point. So let me play a clip from that, and then we'll come back and talk about it, because you know what? We're on the radio. We can use the horizontal, the vertical, and who knows what else. Let's try this. Ooh. Now I gotta bring you into that. That might be harder.
Yeah, that would be hard. Okay.
I find this interesting here, the relationship between man and machine. It's a robot working with a man. Also, another thing about Detroit, which is unusual in America, is that the union was very powerful of auto workers. Not only was it very powerful, but it was desegregated. As with the radio stations, because Detroit was used as a testing ground for new musical formats. So the listening public were exposed to varied styles of music, including European electronic pop. The most important band, though, really, without doubt, are Kraftwerk, a German band who made electronic music in the 70s and 80s. We should think of them as prophets rather than musicians, because they predicted the world we live in now and wrote songs about it. The band toured America in 1981, which would have been a transformative experience for the audience and the band. For me, this image is like a contemporary history painting. It's Europe saying hello to America, basically.
And it's Kraftwerk on stage, so, you know, with a bunch of kids.
Handing on something almost, handing the means of production on to someone. But just to show how appreciated this music was and how unexpected it was in terms of how people reacted to it, this is footage on a TV show in Detroit.
This is when they're dancing to Kraftwerk. So we can go on, I could watch that to the end of days. And I'm not sure how well the audio came over. I know I should have looped you in. I should have thought of that before, Lauren, so I apologize. That's my bad. But for those of you who are listening, hopefully you heard Jeremy Deller, and that's the lecture that we watched. He's giving it in front of a group of 12th graders, 13th graders, I don't know how you'd say that in Britain, who, and then basically he's talking about the auto workers in Detroit, the post-industrial space, the birth of electronic music via Kraftwerk, and then the final piece is the way in which the community in Detroit started dancing to this, you know, seemingly, you know, completely almost like the idea of an Irish jig, right? Like the, it should be controlled, but it's completely off the hook the way they're dancing to it. And it just changes. Like, you don't look at Kraftwerk in the same way after that. It's just like, what? So we'll include a clip in the post and hopefully on Twitter. It's at minute 13 if you see the video. But it's just a super interesting moment of this cultural history. And I think what I really love about it, Lauren, and why seeing it was so inspirational is every lecture should be like that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just so cool.
I think as well, like, I suppose that if so, when you see the whole film, there is, it's almost like he's trying to kind of weave together and hand over, like, almost like folklore for that time, and like so people can own it and then make sense of it for themselves. So I wouldn't say it's, you know, it's not a strict history. And at some points, like, the students ask him questions, and he's like, well, I think. Like, and he's like, oh, this is my sense, or this is how I felt at the time, or, oh, should we try and empathize with them? Which is what you should, I think, if you're teaching people, you should be teaching them in that way as well, and bringing your own perspective. But he's not pretending this is the definitive history. He's just like, well, some people still think this about this or whatever, but I really like this kind of thing. And yeah, it is more like a, almost like a folklore for that time that might otherwise be forgotten.
Well, it's funny because he starts the whole thing of, I'm going to tell you a story. And he tells a series of stories. He tells the story of the birth of house. He then tells the story of the labor moment, the miner strike in 84. He then tells the story of, you know, the reaction against this birth of a kind of new rave culture. And then he tells the story about how maybe... And I think it was a really interesting point, and it hit home, is music in some ways replaced by social media as the medium and the means for expression and identity, which I think many of the students in that room who were responding really could see that. You know what I mean? Like, it was visible.
Yeah, definitely. But they were also talking about how, so there's a couple of clips where people that used to attend raves actually talked about the couple of summers that they spent going to parties and raves, and them saying that they're so glad and thankful that they had those carefree summers where they didn't have to think about social media. You could literally turn up dressing whatever you wanted. You didn't have to turn up with friends. You could just be on your own and just enjoy your time there. And they were saying that they... are very glad that they had that kind of youth. And the students in the classroom with Jeremy Deller were kind of thinking through that and saying that almost there's a level of scrutiny and control that comes with social media, the fact that people carry around phones. And if someone started, you know, pulling shapes like in that Kraftwerk video or, you know, any of these raves, like, straight away it would be on social media, or you feel like people are looking at you and are kind of taking in what others are doing in that space rather than you just being there to be yourself kind of thing. And they're reflecting on, you know, the freedom that comes with that kind of thing.
And there was that sense of all the people, and it's weird because in some ways it sounds like, you know, when I was old, when I was young, there were no phones. We weren't attached to our phones. Hey, kid, get out of your, get your seat and go enjoy, you know, a walk, which can sound very dated, right? Like, but at the same point, like, everyone talked about the phone, either the kids as a mode of surveillance or the adults in their 40s, some odd, like me, looking back saying it was really nice not to have one. And all the weight that carried, like, it was interesting to see two generations try and communicate to each other around that change and what that meant. In fact, there was another moment in the documentary, which was one of the heated moments in it, and there weren't many, and it wasn't, well, there was. I mean, the miner strike was very heated and very violent and really interesting in terms of the way that documented. But there is a point when post-miner strike, the argument, the analogy was as Britain lost that war, that civil war is what he calls it in some ways, they gave way to the state, and the state abused it. The state started taking away privileges, like freedoms. They started taking away the ability for people to caravan to Stonehenge. They started taking away the freedom for them to go into fields and have raves, right? Like, there was a real kind of like a lockdown, right? And there was a whole group, and he stops the video at a point, and there's two older folks ready to talk. And he's like, and they're about to make a case against or for these roving kind of what we would call in the U.S. hippies, right? These caravan kids who are going to Stonehenge, and they're not going, so they like took shop in this small town in the outskirts of, or in the countryside of Britain. And they're like, he stops it. He's like, what do you think they're going to say? And they're getting ready to talk. And they're like, well, they're going to say, these kids, they don't know what they're doing. They need to go home. Or they're like basically reactionary. Whereas these older folks were like, I will not stand this aggression of the state to take away the freedoms of these kids to go where they want. And everyone in the room was like, what? I didn't see that coming. And he made it a connection back to the World War II generation of Britain, where they felt like there was some direct cost to what they had. And they had seen the devastation of the Nazis in the 30s and what that meant for the nation and for the world. And there was a real moment where the whole documentary seemed very much like a current event in terms of like what we're going through and that struggle with our sense of, you know, how would you say, of a comfort level with everything that's going on around us, not really seeing what the cost is, but then also taking for granted all those freedoms that the state had been eroding, you know. And it was super eye-opening and super subtle.
I was trying to flick through to find, because I tried to tap down some of those quotes.
He was great. Another thing, while you're looking for that I wonder what you thought about, was that whole discussion around 18 minutes, 20 minutes into the video, where they talked about the West Indian culture in Britain, and similar to the African-American and gay culture in Detroit and Chicago, you had this West Indian culture who, because they weren't allowed to go to the regular bars, they had a whole scene where they would go to like dance halls or gymnasiums or just rent out places. And the technology there was a mobile sound system. And that gave birth to house music, because they imported it and that was part of the music they would play here. And it was just this whole cool thing about this subculture, and that subculture getting, you know, obviously, popularized and then adopted and adapted. It was a great thing. Anyway, I'll let you talk.
He was called Anthony Stevens, and he was talking about he was involved with a few different sound systems in Manchester. So he was describing, basically, young black men being the most kind of ostracized group, or finding it the hardest to find work or kind of find social spaces within Manchester at that time. Basically having to find other ways to kind of make ends meet and things like that. So he basically, there's some found footage or like archive footage in there of him and some other people using Mossai Library and the community centre there to set up a sound system and put on a party, I think. But more often than not, people take their sound system just around to someone's house. So he was describing basically, a sound system is like a big stack of speakers and things like that, so you can play music together. But people would be kind of almost attached their identity to whatever their local sound system was, and like you'd know that you were going to that sound system almost like wherever it ended up being, kind of thing, that week. So describing that as a whole culture. But I thought it was interesting the way that he phrased, I don't know if you've got that as a clip, but so you're saying try and find spaces that the kind of Black community would be accepted within South Manchester, so using community centres and stuff like that. But also that they had to bring their own machines and bring their own entertainment, like there wasn't somewhere that they could go that would have that equipment or would have entertainment for them, kind of thing. I wrote down, it might be slightly paraphrased, but this is the quote that he gave or what he said kind of in the documentary. People think UK house music was invented in 1988 because white people got on it. They heard about this music that young Black kids were playing in the hood. You know, there was no real white underground culture. There was really nothing there for young white kids to get their teeth into. If you want to get on something, this house music was absolutely perfect. And he kind of like, he's basically pointing out that they had a, that was their only way of accessing music or creating a social space, was to have their own speaker stacks and then going to the library as the young Black community to set up kind of parties or whatever. But almost, it's the, at the beginning of the documentary, they show Waterman and Michaela Strachan's show going around different nightclubs and stuff like that and showing the kind of really, you know, button up kind of like clubs that close at 9 p.m. kind of thing that was going on.
I love that. And he maps like the moment of like between 84, 85 and then like 88, 89 and just completely, it's a beautiful way to start it. And then he shows the like buttoned up, like you said, really uptight. And then 9 years later, it's like they're sweating. They're like on the side. No one's paying attention to them. Everyone's going crazy. Like there's hoodies. There's these hats. It's like Bez. Like everybody's Bez now, right? Like everybody is doing a crazy dance. And
did you notice that was a place called Eclipse in Coventry as well? So the first, and that was the first 24-hour club in the UK. It's the first all-night club. So back when in the early 80s, kind of thing, you know, white working class people did have social spaces that were set up for them that were kind of commercial, but they only had that kind of button up kind of pop music kind of vibe going on. So I thought that was interesting from Anthony Stevens, from that was had his sound system kind of involvement in Manchester, kind of thing, that he was. It was kind of contrasting those two things, that the white working class kids were looking for an alternative to this weird kind of TV acceptable kind of aesthetic kind of thing. And they found, they heard about the kind of house music that Black young kids were making around the country.
Yeah, I like that a lot. Now, let me see if I could do something tricky here. I'm going to see if I can pull both this and this. It's going to be a little bit weird, but I think we can do this. Let's see if it goes crazy. But if you give me 1 second, I think you might be able to hear now what I'm going to play. Let's see. This is when things could potentially go terribly wrong on the radio. We know this, though, and we are ready. So Bava Radio Virtual, can you still hear me?
Yeah, I can still hear you.
Nice. Okay. So let's see. I'm now going to play that clip you were talking about, and you tell me if you can hear it, and then I'll test it and see if it's going on the radio. So here we go. The vertical and the horizontal. This is the part about 16 minutes, 42 seconds in called Soul Control. Here we go.
So what we find is when this music comes to the United Kingdom, it doesn't just go to London. In fact, London isn't the main place for it. It's spread through Black communities in the UK, often through sound systems. So it becomes a national story. And obviously places like Manchester are very important in that story. And Anthony Stevens ran such a sound system, and he's going to talk about it now.
There was high unemployment in Manchester, South Central Manchester in particular, but at the bottom of the ladder was young single black males. Jobs were near enough impossible for people like me to come by. Many of us just made money on the street any which way we could. But underneath it all was always our love of music. Being Jamaican, my parents obviously raised me on reggae music, so that's what I listened to as a child. When my parents first came here, they weren't welcome into white pubs and clubs. So it kind of made sense as to why we were always having house parties, where somebody would basically turn their house into a club for a weekend. If we wanted to have our own events, we had to go to local community centres or local gyms or school halls or whatever, basically because we weren't welcome in the city centre. They didn't have music systems in there, so you'd have to bring your own in order to put an event on. Sound systems were the single most important thing for black music in the UK. I first started off in a sound system called Youthman Promotion, and I absolutely just was spellbound by the whole culture of it. The big boxes, the booming bass, dreadlocks, ganja smoking, I just absolutely loved it. You'd find that there were sound systems that were kind of allied to a certain street or a specific area or a postcode or whatever. And all the young boys in that area, even the girls as well, that was their identity, whether they were directly involved in it or not. They were all part of this big sound system. This was Mosside Library. It was a nice big space. It was in the hood and it was available to us. What you can see at the Mastermind Roadshow here is essentially what we had to do. Basically, a follow-on from our parents from the 50s, the 60s. This is in the 80s. We had to go and find a space somewhere where we were accepted. We then had to go and bring our own machines in there, our own music, and then create our own entertainment, because if we didn't, we'd have had nothing else.
See, that's awesome, because that gets exactly to what you were talking about, you know, he has a Marxist undertone to all of his work. And this whole idea of the means of production, because part of this is the kids in the classroom also making music and kind of returning that. And, you know, there's the argument that social media or the idea of the new web was a maker web, and how that was also, how would you say, hijacked. You know, commercialized, platformed, is its own story that will be told in 30 years from now, if not sooner. But it's interesting to hear this context for the 80s, that the DIY, that the independent spaces, like DS106 Radio, like the places where you could do this stuff outside of the predominant culture, was a fact. Making culture, because everything else was kind of like the first scene where the buttoned up people were trying to dance. Like, I don't know, not to be completely dismissive, but like there was a breath of fresh air to what was happening, and there was this sense of circulation, and there was probably all sorts of problems too, not to overly idealize it, but it really does capture, as this whole lecture does, the notion of music as political and cultural catalyst, as well as thermometer, in a beautiful way. I really love when he talks.
He originally, at the beginning, he gets some of the students to read out some of Karl Marx's writings, basically, and trying to, basically he's prefacing the whole class with ideas of alienation, kind of thing, to describe both what was happening with the miners' strike and disrupting labour organising and things like that, but also why people might have felt the need to kind of create different forms of music, or why they would feel ownership or a sense of agency through repurposing, like he talks about people repurposing Roman 3 or having whatever, to start making their own music, and kind of people just having that DIY approach to things. But he kind of contextualizes it in the work of Marx and Weber at the beginning, kind of thing.
Now, can I ask you a question? Because this is a really good transition from Marx to the miners' strike. Because, so here I'm coming to you as a foreigner. I don't have the same attachment to the miners' strike. In fact, before this documentary, I didn't see it, as I said earlier, as a pivotal event as much as it's framed here. And so from your point of view, like, does that resonate with you? Like, the stories around the miners' strike, the notion that this was a civil war that changed the course of England and in many ways is part of what we're all living right now in the aftermath of things like Brexit and Trump, etc. Like, does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it makes sense to me. But I think it's not really my generation of people don't necessarily know about it that much. I think we know about it through if relatives were affected. So if you live in an area that had a colony and it got shut down, or you know, they were involved in strikes or whatever else. Or so I think my parents would have been late teens, early 20s or something when that was happening, and they were aware in their, when they were young adults, that about like there being food banks around, or like, so my family weren't part of the strikes and stuff like that, but the idea that you might donate food, or you know, put money in a bucket, you know, you go to a gig or whatever and someone would have a bucket there asking for money. Loads of UK punk bands did you know, charity gigs and stuff like that purely just to raise money for miners. So he talked about like basically the decision was made to remove any welfare support for miners to try and force people to return to work, I think. And he talks about how people had to create this parallel welfare state, that people still had this belief, you know, the people at large still have this belief that you have to look after people, and it was wrong. So then you have, you know, people creating food banks, or kind of giving, if they had extra money or food, whatever, they would do that. There's a whole history there of like this interesting history with gay and trans rights movement kind of working alongside the miners' strike. So people looking after, you know, the gay community that have been ostracized, also helping with food banks and stuff like that for miners. There's interesting cultural, not clashes, but you know, like moments or whatever, that there's been films made about, I can't remember, but there's a film made recently about that. Yeah, so it's something I'm aware of, but I was able to have more conversations with my parents about it. Like, they've mentioned that as a cultural moment when I was younger, kind of thing. I think I've had more conversations with them about that purely because of the work of like Jeremy Dale and different people like that that present social histories that aren't available through mainstream education, or they're just not talked about in the media, or that's never provided as a context for things. But that's how I've come to know about them. So Jeremy Dale talks about in this film the Battle of Orgreave briefly, but he made a work where he reconstructed, that is a film he as well as a performance, that he reconstructed the Battle of Orgreave and got so this was a massive fight basically between people on strike and the police, and the police were told in to and go in and use violence and charge the picket line, and he went back in the early 2000s to this town and got the community to reconstruct that battle, but got people, if they were retired policemen, to take on the role of strikers and things like that, to try and build a sense of empathy and kind of, I don't know what you call it, I don't know, just trying to get people to talk about it and kind of come together and have some sort of catharsis, and more like some sort of, it's not a resolution to it, but it's like, just allow people to talk about it and know, you know, like expose it as a trauma almost for their community. So he's done, you'd like his work in general. Well, he's done interesting.
I saw the one he did. Two things I want to say. First is, what I really liked about this documentary, and it does pull into our utopian tendencies, is that by him laying bare the means by which this culture came to be where it is and how it got here, you feel like you can do something about it. Like, you don't feel powerless in the story. You feel like there were people who all along the way had a role in it, and there was a struggle, and it wasn't one-sided, and it wasn't just, you know, take it. And I liked that. And so I liked him using the minor strike as a fulcrum point, because it could have gone the other way too. I mean, that's the other side of that. Like, when you saw the pictures of the folks setting up food banks and the idea that there was a parallel state and it was one that had more empathy, was heartening, right? It was part of this story that I really liked. And so I really enjoyed that tremendously. And I had a second thing. The second thing I wanted to say was Jeremy Deller did a documentary that I really want to see but never got released about Depeche Mode. Basically, he went in to... He interviewed fans in, like, the U.S. and Britain and other places, but supposedly the fans in Eastern Europe and Russia, like, took Depeche Mode to, like, another level. Like, Beatles level. Like, so I guess they're like, which is so interesting to think about. And he said that the film never got released because of the ways in which these people framed Depeche Mode and understood them, it wasn't on brand with what Depeche Mode wants to be seen as. Yet he said it was some of the craziest stories, that he was kidnapped for 3 days by a Russian group of fans who took them hostage.
And they made, I should laugh.
And it's like, and I don't know if it was completely planned. And so, like, that's a documentary. I don't know if it lives somewhere, but gosh, I being a Depeche Mode fan in some ways, not like that, obviously, but and it was the US fans were just like, hey, look at me, I'm gothy. And I think, like, the Russian fans and the Polish fans were not just gothy, right? Like, they were living it. Like, they were like Saw. Just crazy. I was like, this sounds awesome.
I hadn't heard about that before. It's really cool.
Yeah.
He did, I think, actually, got a feeling it might be called Join People, but he did, what do you call it, like a parade kind of thing, you know, when you have like floats and banners and things like that, through Manchester, where he got loads of different community groups to make their own banners. So, and like banner making is a big thing in the UK kind of thing. So with the trade unions and but also just, I don't know, like churches, like Methodists and things like that. All these different community groups in Manchester made their own banners, and lots of them are just, they're quite humorous kind of things. So like Chip Shop owners made a banner and all this kind of stuff. I should find pictures. I could actually reference the images.
I do enjoy, though, on that point, the way that the church and the club were likened, analogized often.
Yeah. So the Methodist movement in the UK is also like kind of responsible for football clubs and things like that. So in the Midlands, the Methodist movement basically, because originally Methodists kind of organised their time by, you'd have so much time for family, for work, for your community, and kind of like organised your time like that. People would meet to play football as part of, like, it's like structured kind of. I don't know, but like also part of community kind of thing. But you'd have like different industrial groups would come together to play football. So I don't know, like Sheffield still has, two major football clubs. One's Sheffield Wednesday and one's Sheffield United. But I can't remember which way around it is. But like basically, the Sheffield Wednesday group met on a Wednesday because their factory was closed that day or whatever, you know what I mean? That was their afternoon off kind of thing. And he's kind of played with that as well, like, before. So he did in Bristol is the first, like, Methodist church, and he's, like, Jeremy Deller's organised kind of public lectures and things like that and cultural events to take place there, almost to try and link in the way that we socially organise ourselves or our kind of social histories with the Methodist movement, or the idea just because Methodist churches as well, you use them almost like community centres as well, currently. So yeah. He's played around with that idea. Like with the kind of parade thing in Manchester, he replicated an entire cafe that was in a local market. And so, like, it's kind of like a greasy spoon type place where you get like a cheap cup of tea and a bacon sandwich kind of thing. And then put it on this float, and it became like the main kind of piece of this parade. But it was like the pride and joy of the community kind of thing. So it's like greasy spoon cafe floating down the street with like people holding bunches of flowers and things like that. He's also done stuff.
That's
with,
genius. Just genius.
he's done things like linking. He called it acid brass. So again, it's mixing kind of the Midlands and North kind of tradition of having brass bands. Like, you know, your factory or colliery would have a brass bands that people could be involved with and stuff like that. Linking that with the history of Acid House. He clearly grew up in the time of Acid House, so that's just like a theme. He uses the like hardcore smiley face in everything that he does and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, he got a Stockport brass band, so the last brass band in Stockport, which is like close to Manchester. He taught them to play acid house music as a brass band, and then they literally toured Europe playing acid house.
That's genius. What a project.
But he like made maps as well, like just hand-drawn maps to kind of describe how different cultural moments like link together. But then he tries to make these living projects, so Battle of All with kind of reconstruction, or people celebrating their communities through floating their favourite cafe down the street kind of thing, or, you know, like brass bands playing music as well. Like, so when the London 2012 Olympics happened, there's loads of artists were commissioned to do different works, and most of them are crap, let's be honest. But he spent his money making a giant inflatable reconstruction of Stonehenge, and it was this massive bouncy castle, like bounce house thing or whatever. And he just put it in the middle of like a Glasgow housing estate. And I remember at the time, like, I thought, oh, that's all right. It's kind of funny. Like, I enjoyed that someone spent their money on that. And then, like, the BBC went to kind of do Vox Pop kind of pieces where people were talking to camera, and literally it would just be like anyone of any age like bouncing off looking really sweaty and like red faced and going, oh, it's amazing. And it's just all these people like pouring like out to like bounce around on the Stonehenge kind of
that's situation. Brilliant. I tell you, and you made me think of something when you talked about Berlin. Well, you made me think of a couple of things when you talk about the Methodist Church, and then when you're talking about Berlin, the Methodist Church, the point that kind of links to is obviously the movement was decentered. In some ways, it was almost impossible to do it in London, given what it took. So you had to go. It started there in some ways, but in other ways, it didn't. And you would have to go to these different clubs in these different cities, like Coventry, right? Like Manchester, other cities, that Lancashire or whatever. And it was interesting to talk about, he said, that's kind of digital, in that it kind of decentered the movement. And it was also a return to the country where a lot of people didn't really know what to do in the country, which I thought was interesting. But there was also kind of towards the end, and your mention of Berlin made me think of this, is there was a pushing out of the entire movement until it had to jump to Berlin, which was one of the few cities that actually engaged it. And the irony is not lost on anyone, for those, you know, the greatest generation talking about freedom and the kids in England having to go back to Germany to find some of that freedom artistically in Berlin. And I just thought it was such an interesting kind of move culturally and historically between the two poles. And the fact that I was always wondering when I was in Brooklyn in the late 90s, early aughts, everyone in Brooklyn was going to Berlin. And I was like, why is everyone going to Berlin? Like, I didn't really understand it, right? And there's some really important artists, obviously, but a lot of Americans jumped ship in the 90s. And like, they went to the Czech in the early and mid 90s, they went to Berlin in the late 90s, early 2000s. And I didn't really fully understand that migration. But this documentary gave me some insight, at least a little bit, to what happened there.
I think that part they're talking about, the New Age travelers. So he talks about both parties and like rave and house culture, which becomes illegal, but also New Age travelers who have like moving sound systems kind of thing that they take from place to place, often to these parties that are taking place in the countryside. But they become nomadic people because they're not allowed to settle and they're literally just traveling from party to party. He starts talking about rights to the countryside and who goes to the countryside and things like that because of that. But then also these people start talking about basically the different points they're getting arrested, and that's the point where those old people that you were mentioning before, who he contextualizes as probably they might have served in the Second World War and things like that, so they've come back to a country where they feel like there's a kind of communal responsibility to look after everyone's good, and they've seen the effects of kind of restricting people's freedoms in other countries and stuff like that. So these people come nomadic and then they're faced by the police, because if they stop, it's almost like the way that travellers and gypsies are treated in the country and stuff like that as well. I keep putting like footnotes in. They start contextualizing their experience, saying that they're like refugees in their own country, because they're kind of hippie types. A lot of them have done work with community groups and refugees and things like that. So there's one guy that's literally saying, I used to work with refugees. I used to help them go through stuff. I literally feel like I'm in their shoes right now because I don't have a home. This is meant to be where I live, and I'm not allowed to settle anywhere. I'm not allowed to be who I am or do what I want to do. And there's the older people that start doing like this kind of defense to camera or whatever. There's another lady who's, probably, I don't know how old she'd be, like in her 30s or something like that. And she's talking about that she's angry that these New Age travellers don't have to do anything. They don't have to contribute. And she says, you're not allowed to just have freedom. You have to earn it. You have to give something to society. You're not allowed to just be free. And she was angry and she's saying, I have to work and I have to look after my 3 kids. I really like that, because this idea of like, working class anxieties, and you can project them back on your own people, basically. You can make others live in fear because you say, you have to work, or you should remain terrified that you're going to lose your job and don't expect anything from your position. It was like she was projecting all her anger about her circumstances in life that had come about through this moving from an industrial kind of economy to a service economy and all this kind of stuff, at these New Age travellers that were just wandering around the country, just living life. And then this old fella kind of comes to their defence and saying, if they want to drink, they're allowed to drink. It's not up to you where they get their money from. If they have money to live in whatever way, then that's how they should be. And he was like, I'll buy them a drink, kind of like leaning in. But it's just interesting, contrasting those. There obviously like there's a generational difference there, where the lady didn't grow up in the kind of directly in the post-war era and stuff like that.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, a couple of things there too that you mentioned. One of them is that hardening of the working class position, right? So when the miners strike, doesn't accomplish it and Thatcher breaks it, like he talks about the entrenchment of the working class and the disillusionment of the working class and the abandonment, and the state's not there. And the rhetoric of the state is, if you're not working, you're not useful. And if you're not useful, you're a New Age traveling hippie and you need to be controlled. And that narrative is interesting too, because in the wake of the miners' strike, and he does a really good job of understanding it as pivotal. And I know Anne Marie is listening, and she's like, yeah, the miners' strike was a absolutely central event for generations of making sense of where they are now. And that idea that these kids go back to these empty warehouses, go back to these post-industrial buildings, and kind of return to them for entertainment rather than for work, almost would double that anger and generational split. And you could see that, like, struggle around that notion of it. But it was super cool too, because Jeremy took a second, I'm calling him Jeremy now, because we're basically like,
you know, right?
It's no longer Deller. It's me and Jeremy. When me and Jeremy were watching this together, because I know he was with me, he basically took a moment out, and it was a really nice moment, of one of the scenes. And just so you know, the documentary we're talking about is on YouTube. It's by Jeremy Deller. It's called Everybody in the Place, and it's well worth watching. He basically stops, and he does this a couple of times, and he says, look at these people. He's like, I mean, I can talk about it as a social history, and I will, but like, these people are so in the moment. Like, and it's something, it's almost like we're not able to do. Like, it's almost that in and of itself is a pure luxury that no one's accounting for, whether it's because of the children the woman's taking care of, or it's because of the war the gentleman fought, or it's the political agenda, you know, this MP or that MP might have. It's this complete closest thing you see to freedom in the documentary is a momentary, just, you know, Bez-like dance, which is just awesome. I love that moment.
I think, yeah, that's, he uses that, he says it's like an inversion point, that instead of people heading towards picket lines for the purpose of work, it's the purpose of entertainment. And they were showing pictures of the roadblocks and the police in the way. Basically, he's showing all the pictures of like the Battle of Algrave and different moments in the miners' strike and food banks and things like that. And then he's then showing pictures of how the police were bodily trying to control people going to illegal parties and things like that. One of the students in the room says, it's interesting to see the police and state's response to music that was different, but the state saw that this movement went against the linear route which they think we need in order to progress and become adults. And so they see it as a threat, the music as a scapegoat for the wider problems they were faced with at the time. Easier to blame music than understand the rising drug use and go to the root of the problems that people face. It's interesting because this is the same issue we are facing now as well. So she kind of that they're almost the same thing, that you as a worker are meant to behave in a particular way, and the idea that people would rebel to go off and party at night kind of thing, it still doesn't fit like the state's idea of what you're meant to do as an adult, like what kind of work you're allowed to perform and all this kind of thing. The students, so they're often like, there's a question phrase then, or they respond to the different clips that they're showing. And they're really doing the work of actually placing it in our current context kind of thing, because they're giving their opinions, but also obviously drawing on their education, because they're studying K-level politics kind of thing. Yeah, I don't know. I just like that.
I think that's cool.
So I typed it down.
And you should have, because it's a nice transition to the next point from the documentary. I'm going to play a little clip, and then we could talk about it. This is that moment where they're talking about the state control and how the media, and you can hear it in this clip, just go right into action. You know, they build the fear, they build the paranoia, they make the case against it, and you start to have these, you know, polarized discussions around house music, and it's interesting. So here, we'll play a little bit, because we're on the radio and we can, right? This is a freedom space. This is me doing house music all night long. Say what? House music all Okay, I'll do it. I'm sorry. I'll play it. Apologize.
But it infected, really, the miners' strike infected the rest of the 80s. So this is Manchester during the Industrial Revolution. And in post-industrial Britain, you have all these spaces that are empty and that are ready for something else. In Blackburn, there were parties which were very different. They weren't as expensive to get into, and they were using factories and places where people had worked until very recently. In the Industrial Revolution, you'd have been in a building with very, very noisy machinery, very hot, and quite dangerous. And then within a generation, people are paying to go into these buildings to socialize and to be deafened by choice. So you're basically sort of dancing in these places where your ancestors maybe worked. These parties are nothing less than a death ritual to mark the transition of Britain from an industrial to a service economy. In the north, just like in the south, it became hugely controversial.
Well, tonight we're coming live from a warehouse somewhere in Lancashire. The location's a secret because we're talking about warehouse parties. As Lancashire sleeps, or tries to, thousands of young people descend on empty warehouses and dance. Drug dens, sex parlours, death traps. These parties have been called almost everything, but what exactly goes on? How much do you know about what happens at acid house parties?
Quite a lot. It's been a nuisance, really, for months on end.
Have you ever been to one, though?
No, I wouldn't step foot inside one.
You're here from the National Council for Civil Liberties.
The main thing I'm concerned about is the policing of these parties, which is excessive and, in fact, is adding to the dangers. If the police are involved, it reminds me when roadblocks... I'm from the National Council for Civil Liberties, and we believe in the rights of people for freedom of assembly. The roadblocks that are set up to try and stop youth from going to parties reminds me of the miners' strike.
And it's there that you see. I'm sorry, let me get off this. Bam, boom, boom, boom. I just wanted to dance.
Day has been turned into night.
Okay. There we go. Let me pause that. But I love that piece, and I'm sorry I insisted on playing it. But I loved it because you have, you know, the media backdrop. You have him talking. It's kind of like he's writing a little bit of his own Marxist, like, this is the death ritual wherein the kids come, where their ancestors would play. I just love it. It's so beautiful. And then you have this scene, and you have this person from the Civil Liberties talking about the power to the police. Now, not to draw too fine a point on it, but that is something that has gotten to ludicrous. I think, have I lost? No, I'm on. Monster, yeah. That has gone to ludicrous levels in the U.S. to the point now where Minneapolis is basically on fire. And we see the kind of armament of the police force. We've seen the kind of the turn to violence. And it's interesting because this moment where someone is actually saying, like, civil liberties, like the miners' strike, is that's the point. And you know, it's a selective editing on the part of the documentary, understood, but it works. And the point really hits for me that this is a beautiful lecture. It's a beautiful video essay. It's a beautiful way to do social history and cultural history. Like, it's everything like a bad blogger like me aspires to. I can never get there, but it's amazing. Thank you, Lauren.
I was going to say, yeah, so the music industry and like the need for youth and social spaces in the UK is in a far more dire space than what's discussed in the film as well. So, although it's interesting, so yeah, something about the film reminded me of this, I'll tweet it out as well, but Jamie, who's a grime artist, about 60 years ago, did like a 20-minute article for Noisy, which is like part of Vice, called The Police versus Grime Music, and he talks about use of the 696 form in London, which is like a Met Police specific form where you as a venue had to request the right to have a musician play music, but it's specifically aimed at DJs and MCs, with the idea that those audience, like basically audiences that would go and see an MC, are more likely to be Black or Asian ethnic minority, kind of heritage and whatever. And it was this very not subtle way of trying to, I don't know, I have no idea where's the logic in that somehow non-white people are more prevalent to violence, so we need to police them in a way where they're not allowed to hang out and listen and play music, I don't know. But anyway, he did a really good, there's no point for me to talk about it, it's just a really good 20-minute piece where he's talking to people he knows in London that have been affected by it. And since then, that form got revoked. It was in place for like 15 years or something. It was there for a long time. And it was a couple of years ago, Steve Khan, who's the current mayor of London, removed it because he just like, basically it was easy to prove that it was blatantly racist kind of thing. But loads of different clubs and spaces to play music have closed down over time because there's not funding there, or the police or whoever else squeeze them out of business kind of thing. But also, so they're talking about like, oh, well, we can do a house party, but actually we're able to perform at the Barbican, or we're able to perform at this massive music venue that you prevent us from doing, sort of kind of thing. And again, it talks about like it builds an anxiety of just to accept that and just not try and make and create good music and stuff like that. But like grime at the moment is kind of like whatever rave punk kind of scene in the UK at the moment. So it's an interesting like a more contemporary context.
What is it called?
The Police versus Grime Music.
Grime.
With Jamie.
I gotta listen to this. We should do a show on grime music.
Absolutely, we should. I was hoping we might get there. It's like there's a lot.
I don't even know grime music.
Let's just do Utopian. You don't know grime music.
I don't. I don't think what? I do. Maybe
this is
I
why
do.
I need to get on the radio. I'm just gonna
exactly.
play loads of grime music.
I don't even. I mean, granted, I'm old, but I don't think I've heard of it.
140 BPM. It's kind of punk, but it's mixed with like dancehall and ragga and kind of bashment kind of sounds, or garage sounds kind of thing. It's really cool.
It sounds cool.
Do you usually have a beat there, and then you have someone like kind of rapping or doing spoken kind
of. It'd be brilliant. I mean, this whole documentary got me like doubling down on doing stuff like that and talking about it and linking the art and the music and all that to discussions of culture, because it's fun. Like, as soon as I started watching, I was just like locked in. I could pull it away for lunch. Everybody in the place. It's on YouTube by Jeremy Deller. Lauren tipped me off. We talked about it today. I think we talked about it absolutely brilliantly. I mean, not just to toot my own horn. Like, we were on. Like, there's being on, and then there's being on. I think we were on.
Especially with that audio piping in as well.
Oh my God, we figured it out, right? We did it again. We did it again. We did it again.
Mad acid house shape. Exactly.
We are dancing right now on the video while we're doing this. Well, look, I don't know. It is utopian because social history in its own right is utopian in that it, you know, predetermines who tells the story and how it ends.
He pretty much ends the documentary as well. He's, again, he's obviously an acid house head, that's his time. Yeah. But he kind of throws a little bit of shade at the punk kind of scene, what was the legacy of punk? And he's saying, this is the legacy of acid house and rave. And he kind of talks about, instead of just having a DIY approach to make your own music and talk about things, or this, the movement to make social spaces for others and bring people together. So he's talking about the scale of rave, that 40,000 people could turn up and share in that cultural moment and be completely you. You don't have to worry about anyone else. You just love what you love, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that is a kind of like utopian vision about how to create those social spaces for others and allow people to be themselves or to have a sense of freedom and more ownership.
But the problem with house music and rave as imagined through the rave culture is the same problem with Occupy New York in 2011, 2012 was they adopted the hippie aesthetic. And, you know, they needed something else. They needed their own aesthetic. It's like it ultimately seems to go back to the hippies. And I think that's where I start to lose a certain amount of interest. Not that I'm against new movements, but whenever, because then it gives the 60s boomers people all sorts of space to be like, yeah, man, but you weren't at Woodstock, dude. You didn't see it. I don't want to hear that. I want my own culture. I'm done with you 60s people. I'm Gen X, damn it. Leave me alone. You hearing where I'm coming from? This is what it's like to get old, bro.
I'm with you. It's like, yeah.
This is exactly, you want to know what it's like to get old? This is what it's like. Don't do it. It's not fun.
I'm just watching it live.
You're listening live to a man getting old. But yeah, it was interesting. And he said, the quote was, yeah, it was more punk than punk. And I was like, he's definitely taking a shot at punk. But there is something to what he's saying, because when you can mobilize 40,000 people and effectively create a DIY stadium, like, you know, all the infrastructure that goes into these stadium acts like U2 and the like to make all this money, and you got these promoters, that one woman who's just doing it, and it's just like, wow. There is something there. I do agree with them to some degree.
But, I don't know, punk in the UK did make their own space and stuff like that, but they were small. And it was that he was talking about how, I can't remember her name, but the lady that started, like, basically rave parties or whatever, her and her mates went from Milton Keynes down to a 100-person venue in London, and it was like they were trying to travel down there and often couldn't get in, kind of thing. She was like, yeah, but I want my mates to experience the experience I had like last weekend, and now we can't get in. And she's like, we're just going to start our own parties then. And like, it's that, it's like deliberately trying to bring others in, and don't pretend you're the cool person, bring other people in, like, you know, share it with others, kind of thing. But also, like, we were talking about the Miners Strike and stuff like that, if different punk bands had to make sure there's someone with a charity bucket on the dog to help the Miners Strike, that's probably value enough. I don't know. Like, there's definitely a legacy there for sure, and they did their part.
Yeah, I mean, and it's funny because the thing about that documentary I love is it shows the interconnections and the fluidity of all of it. Like, you know, the identity systems are important to feel like you belong to something, but yet it also shows you how it operates culturally and systemically on another level. And so it allows you to enjoy that, even if that's not what you were. Like, if you weren't like a raver at house music, you have a newfound respect. I do, at least, for that whole movement. And I really like that. So it was great. Yeah. Mission accomplished.
Cool. Okay. We should talk about Brian next time.
Yeah. We got to figure out what we're going to do next. But I think there'll be a next.
Yeah, there should be.
There should be. Maybe Grime. Let's do a full show. Maybe we should actually plan a radio show. Like, you have a song, and I'm like, you say, here it is, play it, and then I'm like, what's this music? What do you have?
Stop shaking your stick. Why is this on my radio?
Get this off the radio. This isn't music. It would be perfect.
Yeah, sounds cool.
All right. Bye-bye, Lauren. Bye-bye, DS106 Radio.
Yeah, bye, listeners.
Thank you for listening.
Have a good day.
Enjoy the weekend. Bye-bye. Okay, here we go. DS106 Radio. DS106 Radio.
For life.
Yes.
Sorry.
That was what I was looking for.
Oh, that wasn't smooth.
That's what I was baiting you for. Bye-bye.